awaken to all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. Prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, urging, supplicating, whatever virtue I've collected, I dedicate it to awakening. The ground perfumed and strewn with flowers, Meru for continents, sun and moon, this imagined Buddha field offering, may all beings dwell in the pure realms. According to the different propensities of beings, please turn the wheel of Dharma, great, lesser, and uncommon. Tadan san shantam chelo chisu drawers in G love to soul, chulam to drawers in G love to soul, am chulpa sowers in G love to soul, chulpa yeshisu chowers in G love to soul. I pray for blessing. May my mind and the minds of all sentient beings turn toward the Dharma. I pray for blessing. May the Dharma become the path. I pray for blessing. May the path clarify confusion. I pray for blessing. May confusion arise as wisdom. Lai ke dang lu dang nu chen ke chulpam dadami ke nam dang drawa kunji drake jitsam par tam je ke du dek ich attento. In the tongues of Nagas, Yakshas, gods, those of humans and of demons too, and the many languages there are, may I teach the Dharma in them all. And the reminder for arousing bodhicitta, if you have that sheet, we can chant it together, and if not, just listen and make the same aspirations for aspiration and action bodhicitta. Let us begin by giving rise to the thought that in order to benefit all sentient beings whose numbers fill the extent of space, I must attain the level of perfect enlightenment. In order to bring this about, I will practice the profound Mahayana Dharma by way of study, contemplation, and meditation. Oh, I guess we're going to do our, I need my right meditation sheet. Right. All right, we shall meditate. And today we're going to do our usual two wings of awakening, but with the thought of how it applies to the paramitas or how the paramitas apply to it. So last week we did kind of an impromptu meditation on, at the end of the generosity paramita, on taking and sending as generosity. So I think we can all see how that is, that taking and sending, in taking and sending, you're generously taking on the suffering of all sentient beings. That's your aspiration, and you are generously giving away all of your happiness and accomplishment and so forth to all sentient beings. But we can also all of the other paramitas apply, I think. So today, the ethics paramita, we have kind of a new name for that that I really like, that I got from Pema Chidren's seminar last weekend, which is skillful action. So when we do taking and sending, and even when we're doing sitting, resting in the nature of mind, we are cultivating bodhicitta. And that is the point of ethics, is to cultivate, to refrain from harm to others, to cultivate our own bodhicitta, and to benefit others. So taking and sending is also about benefiting others, as well as cultivating our own bodhicitta. So it fulfills the paramita of ethics or skillful action. Patience, how does it fulfill patience? We could think about that for a second. It would take a lot of patience to really take on someone else's suffering, but it also takes patience to do the practice. You know, we got many other things to do, but we take the time patiently, sort of taming our restlessness and our need to check off the to-do list, and we sit and we do this practice. So that's patience, I think. And we do it cheerfully. And then perseverance, that's pretty clear. Doing it as often as you can, doing it, you know, doing it day to day, that's perseverance. Meditation, got that one covered. And wisdom, if we do taking and sending with what is called threefold purity, I'm kind of liking that translation for free of the three spheres or three of three free parameters, that, you know, this is the wisdom. I don't know if everybody has studied the wisdom paramita. I think everybody has, but basically what makes each of the paramitas, wisdom, like how wisdom applies to them, is to realize the emptiness or the illusory nature of the person who's doing the action, the person who's receiving the action, and the person and the action itself. So with a recognition of the emptiness of whatever we do, that turns taking and sending into the paramita of wisdom. So you don't have to remember all that, but just know that just by doing this practice, even without thinking about it or analyzing it, we really are fulfilling all of the paramitas. So we start once again by just bringing our minds to rest a little bit in our straight but relaxed posture. John, I'm assuming you got the record permission. Okay, great. And within this state of rest, rest just means not being distracted by something else. So in the state of not being distracted, of resting our mind in the present moment, we will briefly, because we're running a little late, contemplate the four reminders, just bringing each one to mind, appreciating our precious human existence, this opportunity to practice, to study, contemplate, and practice, and progress toward enlightenment in this lifetime. And then remembering impermanence and death, we know what that means. With us always, dying every day, as Mindy Rinpoche says. Also remembering karma, that it's up to us what our future holds, what our next life holds, what the future in this life holds to some extent. Happiness, suffering, or liberation depends on our actions. And then the suffering of samsara, remembering that it's all suffering. In the end, there's no place in samsara that's safe from suffering. So we have to free ourselves and aspire to also free others from it. And that's why we practice those four reasons. So now we'll briefly bring to mind our teacher, the Buddha, whoever we feel the strongest connection with, who's helped us the most in our Dharma practice. Visualizing them above the crown of our head in a body of light, radiating love, compassion, and bodhicitta, fully awake, really recognizing that. Requesting with or without words their blessing to empower us to attain the same state, the same level of realization. Feeling that wish in our heart and knowing that just through asking we receive it, because it's always there. We just have to connect with it. And having received this blessing, this empowerment of our practice, we visualize the teacher or the Buddha descending into our heart center, where they remain either in their form, the form of Dorje Chang usually, or as light. So with that empowerment, we'll quickly go through the steps of cultivating ultimate bodhicitta, which is really the wisdom of the wisdom paramita, connecting with our innate wisdom. So the first step is to look at everything we're experiencing in this moment and all the time throughout our lives as a dream. Same quality as a dream. Same wakeable up fromness as a dream. Just letting go a little bit of feeling, taking things as real. And then turning our attention inward to examine the nature of unborn awareness, our true nature. Connecting with it by asking, does it have a location? Does it have a color? Does it have a shape? Does it have any identifiable characteristic? Just by asking the question, not analyzing it, but just asking, it directs our attention to it in a way that allows us to see it clearly. So making that connection with our inner awareness. And then we let even the remedy release naturally, meaning that act of looking, any conceptuality we have about what our mind is or is not, we just let that go. And that brings us to rest completely in the essence, the basis of everything, by which is meant our Buddha nature, reality, the three kayas, whatever you want to call it. So we'll just rest there for a moment, letting thoughts come and go, not getting attached or hooked on any thought, but just letting our minds go freely where they will, while maintaining this awareness of the awareness of it ourselves. And now, having established this state of rest, we don't have time to linger in it today, but within it, without losing touch with it, or when we recognize we've lost touch with it, coming back to recognizing it, we'll practice taking and sending alternately, synchronizing with the breath. Again, we could think of this as almost the ultimate generosity, short of Buddhahood, perhaps. Bringing to mind all sentient beings and any sentient beings within it that we have a connection with, knowing that they're suffering, wishing in a heartfelt way to free them from that suffering, and doing that, aspiring to do that, and putting it into action to do that by breathing in their suffering. The generosity of taking on the suffering of all sentient beings and specific sentient beings so that they may be free from it, without regard for ourselves. On each in-breath or every few in-breaths, we take in the suffering of all beings in all the six realms, and the suffering of beings that we know and love, beings we feel indifferent toward, we know casually, and even beings that we have a difficult relationship with. Taking it in on the in-breath, freeing them from it, letting it dissolve. And then on the out-breath, the generosity of giving away to all sentient beings and to individual sentient beings all of our happiness, all of our merit, all of our wealth and possessions, everything we have to give, breathing it out, perhaps in the form of white light or rainbow-colored light. Imagining it striking all sentient beings, filling them with all of it, all the happiness, peace, healing, etc. Doesn't leave us without it because it's inexhaustible, but we give it with the intention of giving it all away. Alternating taking and sending for a couple of minutes. And also letting go of the notion that there is someone who is doing taking and sending, someone who is receiving it, and anything any transaction happening. It's just as much a dream as the first step of ultimate bodhicitta. And yet we also aspire for it to be really happening in relative reality. May we really free beings from suffering. May they really be filled with our happiness, our healing, and our peace. And now, before we come back to study and contemplation, sort of mixing our meditation with it a little bit, remembering that we're also fulfilling the paramita ethics or skillful action by cultivating our bodhicitta in this way and by aspiring to benefit beings and really taking an action that we think will benefit them. The paramita of patience, not worrying about the result, doing it cheerfully. The paramita of perseverance, the paramita of meditation, and the paramita of wisdom by remembering that this too is just a dream. So now we take one more moment to think that all beings are completely freed from suffering, completely filled with whatever they need, including happiness, health, and peace, completely awakened, including ourselves, through this practice. Taking a moment to rejoice in that, as we would rejoice if we really were 100% awakened and able to help beings in such a way. And now coming back to just open awareness, or resting in the essence, letting go of all visualization, all conceptuality, just resting. And now coming back to study and contemplation mode. Anybody have any questions or comments before we launch into the second paramita? Since some people have to leave early and some people have a precarious connection, technologically speaking, the good news is that Ringu Tulku is very short. So we're going to cover the whole thing pretty quickly, and then we're going to look in more detail, a little more detail at Ornament of Precious Liberation, and even a little bit at Trungpa's book, Training the Mind, which is a mind training text. But first, a little recap. So where are we? We've taken refuge, like the path of bodhicitta is, we've taken refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and we have generated aspiration bodhicitta, and we are now in action bodhicitta, the second kind of bodhicitta. The six paramitas are the action part of bodhicitta. They are the action in the action bodhicitta. So they are the practices, the actual practices we engage in to realize our aspiration bodhicitta, which is to wake up fully in order to help all other beings do the same. So as Lama Norla Rinpoche used to say, and I hear this all the time in my head, Dharma is not a hobby. It shouldn't be a hobby. When you sign up for the Bodhisattva path, you really mean it. And it becomes your life. Like the more you study, contemplate, and meditate, the more it becomes your life, the more you can apply it in every moment. If we genuinely want to wake up as bodhisattvas and Buddhas, then it becomes our life. We're allowed to backslide here and there. Pema Chidrin's seminar, it was all about, she taught on the paramitas last weekend, and it was all about it being a journey. It's not like we're here on this side and we perfect the paramitas and we're on the other side. It's like, it's all about getting there. Like whatever level we're at, progressing at whatever our pace is, we don't have to practice the paramitas perfectly. We won't. It's all a process. And I know that, we all know that, but I was still inspired to hear her, emphasize that so much. Like, don't expect yourself to practice generosity perfectly or all these lists of, skillful actions in the second paramita perfectly. But they're aspirations, and through putting them into practice as much as they can, they turn into reality, and we do progress gradually. So let's see, I made myself a couple of notes. The six paramitas are how to live the life of a bodhisattva. So know them. This is a list you need to memorize. You need to know at every moment, what are the six paramitas? And today we're going to get a very specific list of how to act like a bodhisattva. Like, what does a bodhisattva do? A bodhisattva engages in skillful action. We first got generosity. So we started with generosity, and there's a reason for that, to review a little bit. Rengu Tulku says in his introduction to the Six Paramitas, and I'm quoting here, it's on page 81, but I'm not looking at the book at the moment. He said, notice that the Six Paramitas are presented in the logical order of our progression on the path. And here he was paraphrasing Gampopa, who said that definite order was one of the topics under his introduction to the Paramitas, under the Paramitas in general. And he said they are presented in the order in which they develop in our mental continuum. Generosity is really the first one that we might see coming to fruition, and then skillful action and so on. They lead to each other. So he said they're in the order in which they develop. They are also like where one leads naturally to the next. They are also in the order from lesser to higher, from generosity to full-fledged wisdom. That is also a progression. It's like an advancement. Can you guys hear that helicopter that's flying really close? Good. Okay. I have very good, I forget what you call it, noise cancellation. Okay. And it's also from easiest to hardest. So generosity is in some way the easiest to practice, and skillful effort, skillful action a little harder, and patience a little harder, and perseverance a little harder, meditation, and then wisdom. We're going to spend some time on wisdom because that is a difficult one. But we will be rewarded by all of our efforts. And again, we don't expect perfection of ourselves, even though they're called the perfections. It's a process of perfection. And when we look in the Bodhisattva Levels chapter, which is the third chapter from the left, we will see that each of the 10 Bodhisattva Bhumis involves the perfection of one of the paramitas, like the complete perfection of one of them. First Bhumi level, completion of generosity. Second Bhumi level, completion of skillful means, and so on and so forth in the same order. And then there's the four extras for the 10 paramitas that are added on to the end. So 10 bodhisattva levels, 10 paramita perfections. So we started with generosity for those reasons. Just to recap the definition of generosity, another thing it's really helpful to have in your mind, though I wrote it down to make sure, to give completely with an unattached mind. That's Ken Holmes's translation. And one of the other translations also adds to give something of value, that is of value, to give it completely with an unattached mind. So our generosity is perfect when we can do it that way. But to whatever degree we can be generous, even if it's grudging generosity, it totally counts. So please, again, don't fall into the trap of thinking you have to be perfect with it. Like, every act of generosity has to be analyzed in this way. It does help to look back, you know, when you feel, oh, I gave something to someone. It helps to look back and say, well, was it unattached? Like, do I kind of wish I hadn't given it? But you're okay. It's okay. You just acknowledge that feeling. It ain't perfect yet. It's helpful to look at where you are. And so, you know, the classic example for generosity is if generosity is hard, practice picking up something in one hand and giving it to the other hand. And that's meant quite seriously. Like, you can start there, and that counts as generosity. So we started with generosity, and the three we want to remember, like, these are the highlights. These are the things that it's really good to remember, the definition of generosity and the three types of generosity. So let's take a moment, silent pop quiz. What are the three types or aspects of generosity, and what three ways is a bodhisattva generous? I can see everyone remembers. material generosity, like stuff, giving stuff to people who need it or who like it. Pema Chodron gave the example of in her own life of aspiring at some point, like, for one day, if anybody admires something I have, I will give it to them. And fine, that's easy. Fine, that one's easy. And then they wanted, like, her gal. Somebody said, oh, what a lovely amulet you're wearing. And she couldn't give that away. So that was okay. So it's the aspiration and the intention, but we have to respect our limits. And I'm going to keep emphasizing this. Pema Chodron emphasized it. I'm going to emphasize it. Respect your limits. If you make that kind of a vow, like, I'm just going to practice generosity perfectly for a day, and somebody asks for something that you really, it's just going to tear you apart to give it. Just don't, you know, but aspire. Like, I aspire. And she said, you know, make the aspiration, may, before the end of my life, may I be able to give away even this. So, three kinds of generosity, very important to know. If you don't know them, go back and review them. This is the school marm talking. And the definition, those are the things I would say take away. And so what are the three, just in case anybody was wondering? Material generosity, freedom from fear, which we could also interpret as just being supportive of someone who needs support of some kind, not monetary necessarily, but a sick person, you sit with them, you bring them food, like whatever you can do for them, and giving dharma. So those are the three kinds of generosity, and that is where we are now. So through generosity and alongside it, so, you know, if they unfold one from the other, then maybe we focus most on generosity until we feel we've perfected it, but we work on all the others at the same time. So now we're going to start working on skillful action or ethics, discipline, morality. Those are all the names for it. The translations, it's Tsultrim in Tibetan, Shila, S-H-I-L-A in Sanskrit. It means to cool. It's something that cools our emotional poisons, our mental afflictions. It cools them off. Like, it's the discipline of not fanning the flames. And we're going to learn there's three ways to not fan the flames, to develop that. But we're going to start with Ringu Tulku in less than two pages. He's going to lead us through this whole thing. It's 10 pages in Gampopa, and it's just, to me, it's just a scintillating chapter. So I hope everybody had a chance to read it, or if you didn't read it yet, I hope you will read it, because it's so chock full of, as Pema Chodron says, news you can use. I think this is the first seminar I've live streamed with her where she didn't actually call something news you can use. But this is news you can use. Every single, there's lists in it, like how to practice this kind of ethics and how to practice that kind, the three categories, like all really practical stuff. So we are on in Ringu Tulku, we are on page 87. And he calls it ethics or right conduct. And I like this new name, skillful action, which is non-judgmental. I think the other terms we have in English are a little bit judgmental, like, are you ethical? Are you practicing morality? Are you practicing discipline? But skillful action, it's like, okay, it's skillful or it's not skillful. If it's not skillful, it needs to be adjusted to skillful. So, and that comes from a book called Deep Hope that Pema Chodron recommended. I think it's a fairly new book by someone named Diane Rizzetto. If you look on Amazon for Deep Hope, it will come up. And I couldn't tell. Apparently, it is about the Paramitas, but it may, you know, have a wider scope than that. But she used that. She was influenced by that in her teaching last weekend. So Ringu Tulku, what does he have to say to us about the second Paramita of skillful action? He says, to follow a moral code, to have a right way of living, means to abstain from doing what is negative and to act in a positive way. So the way that this one is usually expressed is like the first aspect of ethics or skillful action is to refrain from harm, refrain from harming any other being. So that's what this means. To have a right way of living means to abstain from doing what is negative and to act in a positive way. Usually negative is what hurts others or ourselves. Positive is what helps others or ourselves, helps them in a dharmic way. To develop a way of life that is good for us and can help others is the basis of the other virtues, the foundation of subsequent spiritual development. So without ethics, you're not going to get very far in your aspiration to be a Buddha. Without discipline and right conduct, we won't go very far. If we fail to abstain from committing negative deeds and don't live in a positive way, our lives will be neither agreeable nor pleasant, but on the contrary, troubled, perturbed, and tense. Where have we heard that before? Chapter 5, Karma. If we engage in helpful actions, we have happiness. And if we engage in harmful actions, we have trouble. So he says, he goes on to say, we'll lack the conditions necessary for our spiritual development. There's nothing to build on if you don't have a basis of knowing what to adopt and what to abandon. And we'll lack the conditions for the stabilization of our meditation. Everything depends on this. So, here, you know, here we're also talking about the basic blueprint for this, like how to live this kind of a life, right? We also encountered in the Karma chapter, the 10 on virtuous actions. Those are the 10 big headings for what kinds of actions to avoid. And then their counterparts, the 10 positive actions, are the blueprint for like how to live in a dharmic way, a way that helps you progress on the path. So Gyanpopa distinguishes three aspects of right conduct. So these are the three things to remember. You don't have to remember the details, but it's worth it to study them. It really points us in some very useful directions. But remember the three headings, the three ways that we practice ethics or skillful action. First is acts we must abstain from. I'm just checking my email because something came in and it might be somebody who couldn't get in. Nope, not that. Now I'm turning off the sound. Okay. I'll assume everybody's here who wants to be by now. Acts we abstain from. So it means refraining from harm. That's the first one, to refrain from harm. This is the ethic of abstention, of observance, the restrictions that correspond to the precepts of the Vinaya and to the vows of Pratimoksha. This lands us squarely in that thing we got into trouble with in the refuge chapter. And I'm not going to dwell on it here because I think we talked about it pretty extensively, but I believe that this is where that came from. When Gampopa said in the refuge chapter that in order to fully cultivate bodhicitta, we need four things. One is refuge and one is one level of pratimoksha vow. And remember that Rinku Tulku did not put it that way. Vows seem to be optional. I think this is where he's explaining that more fully, like why do we need vows? And we need vows because they are a support for not causing harm. That's what all the, like the lists of vows that you take, it's 200 and some for fully ordained monks. Those are all the things that you refrain from so that you don't harm beings in any way. So I'm going to finish reading this and then I'm going to just address that piece of it. Like how do we relate to that one more time? But I think I can do it more intelligently having realized that this is where what he's talking about. So the vows group together different levels, such as the five precepts of lay disciples. That's the Genyan vows, are the ones I hold. The vows of novices and of fully ordained monks and nuns. From the point of view of the Vinaya, which is like the one of the three baskets, main headings of the Buddha's teachings, it's conduct, how you should conduct yourself on the path if you're an ordained person. Specifically, from the point of view of the Vinaya, discipline is focused on actions performed with body and speech. The rules are very, because you can't really regulate mental actions, right? But you can regulate speech and actual physical action, and then you know if there's been an infraction. Other people know if there's been an infraction, and there can be a discipline for that if you're a monastic. So from the point of view of Vinaya, discipline is focused on actions performed with body and speech. The rules are very precise as to what we can or cannot do, what we can or cannot say. These vows prevent us from taking a wrong direction because it is so spelled out, not so spelled out in the Genyan vows, the lay vows, there's only five, but really spelled out by the time you get to full ordination. So, so I think, let's see. So I think it's clear to me, I mean, speaking to lay people, you know, people who are not monastic, have not taken all those vows are guidelines, and they're very specific guidelines. We can certainly accomplish the same thing. We don't know what all the vows are, so we probably can't keep them all because we don't know what they are. But certainly the 10 on virtuous actions are the five Genyan vows, lay vows. You know, whether you took them or not, you could still keep them. You don't have to hold the vow. You can still not kill anybody and not steal and not engage in sexual misconduct, like sexual conduct that's harmful to someone, or take intoxicants or lie. Those are the five vows. And we can absolutely do those things without having the vow. But having the vow, so the advantage of having the vow, and I'm, again, not encouraging people, not saying we need to do it, but the advantage of having the vow is it's in your face. When you have a vow not to kill, and it really increases the negativity if you do accidentally or purposely kill someone. And so you don't forget that. When we take sojong vows, we take those vows, all five of those vows we take when we do nyungne. And it helps us, not eating really helps us remember all the other vows, because not eating is something we can't forget. We're not eating. But it keeps them really in your mind when you have a vow. So you're much more careful, is my experience. Like, oh, I am much more careful about how I treat the ants on my counter, knowing that if I kill an ant by accident, certainly if I kill an ant on purpose, which there have been some close calls, it's really serious. It's really serious when you have a vow. So that might be the disadvantage of taking vows. But the advantage is it keeps it in your mind. You can't forget it. And also, it is said, and it was in something we read recently, it must have been a myth probably, but I can't remember exactly where it was. When you hold vows, they are operative all the time. So they operate even when, like, you're not refraining from killing the ants on your counter or being careful not to kill them. When you're sleeping, you're still benefiting from that vow. You're still accruing merit from not killing, even when you're not engaged in not killing specifically. So I don't know if that's clear completely. We're not going to dwell on it. But again, this is just informational, like just to figure out why did Gampopa say that? And I think it's really clear now why he said that. And we live in a different world. So I think knowing what the vows are can be helpful, even if you don't want to take them. It's good to know that the Buddha said, don't kill, don't steal, don't engage in sexual misconduct, don't lie. And he thought intoxicants were a thing that really hamper us on the path. So he said, don't do it. But we get to decide which of those vows you want to keep. And at the very least, it's fairly easy to not kill. Not kill and not steal, and maybe try not to lie. And that's really beneficial to us and to everyone we encounter. And if we have the vow, even when we're asleep, we get credit for it. So anybody have any questions or comments on that before I move on? I don't want to leave anybody with any level of discomfort over this. We all good? Okay. And, you know, I'll take questions later, or you can email me. But I just think it's clear now, and that makes me happy. So that's the first one. That's sort of all the details about refraining from harm. That's the first level of ethical conduct or skillful action. Second level is positive actions that favor the development of bodhicitta, that is our compassion and our wisdom. So it means practicing the Dharma. Second one is to practice the Dharma, to do our own practice, our own study, contemplation, and meditation that strengthens our ability to develop into a bodhisattva and to act in a bodhisattva-like way. So he said, this is called in Tibetan the discipline that allows us to acquire what is good and positive. This accumulation of positive actions encompasses study, meditation, rejoicing in the happiness of others, encouraging others to perform positive actions. This is a good list here. You might want to mark this list. This is a good list. These are ways that we strengthen our own bodhicitta. Rejoicing in the happiness of others, encouraging them to perform positive actions, making offerings, practicing the six paramitas. Just by practicing the six paramitas, we are strengthening our bodhicitta. And so on. In short, all that will develop our practice is bodhisattva. So anything that develops our own practice and our own compassion and wisdom, that falls under the second aspect of skillful action. The precepts at this level, so this is like an interesting point. I was going to skip this, but I'm going to read it. So in the first type of skillful action, it's about refraining from harm, and there's lists. Don't kill, don't steal. It's very absolute. Just don't do it. Over 200 infractions you could have to confess if you're fully ordained monk or nun. But here, like at this level, at the level of, say, holding the bodhisattva vow or reinforcing your own bodhicitta, precepts function differently. And I would think this probably refers to the bodhisattva vow. I mean, I don't know what other precepts there are at this particular level. So anyway, he says the precepts at this level mainly take into account the state of mind. So you're not looking here at this level, you're not looking at what the action was so much as you're looking at the intention. And most of the time, positive intention, positive action. Negative intention, negative action. But it can be different. And you may remember that from the karma chapter in Torch of Certainty, where Jamgon Kongcho talks about mixed actions and how to analyze them. But here, so you're looking in not so much at the act itself, but at the underlying intention and motivation. So Rinku Tulku says, what can and cannot be done is therefore not precisely listed, say for the Bodhisattva vow. Thus, a seemingly bad action can in fact be motivated by an altruistic intention and will be defined as good at this level because the intention was pure. This is not giving us wiggle room. Like, it really does have to be a good intention. We can't sort of backtrack and rationalize. Whereas it would be condemned at the Vinaya level, an action that appears to harm someone or appears to violate, like you told a lie, but you told the lie in order to actually, for the greater good. And we all know that that can be the case. So in the Vinaya, the lie itself is wrong. There's like no real exceptions, but at the Bodhisattva level, you might have to lie to benefit somebody. So he says, on the other hand, an apparently good action can be hypocritical and in fact motivated by bad intentions. And I think we all can recognize that that happens too. And at the Bodhisattva level, it would be considered a negative deed. Even if the deed itself was good, you told the truth, but you destroyed somebody. Technically at the Vinaya level, you did the right thing. At the Bodhisattva level, not so much. That's the first two. Anybody have any questions before we go to the third? All right. So third kind of skillful action or ethical conduct, work for the benefit of others. So this is where we find ourselves seeing that engaged Buddhism is in the scriptures. This is engaged Buddhism. This is what we're supposed to do as bodhisattvas. And maybe sometimes we're in retreat and we're not out in the world doing things for people, but I'll tell you, in retreat, you can practice every one of these things towards another person. We practice them towards individuals. We practice them with a greater scope if we can, but engaged Buddhism is already here and it's etched into Gampopa. And we just have to practice it. So working for the benefit of others is the third kind of ethical conduct or skillful action. And for some reason, Rinku Tulku says there's 13 of them. In Gampopa, there's only 11. And I analyzed that at some point back, I think the first time I taught this text, and realized that he had just made two. Like, he had listed a couple of things as two instead of, like, in Gampopa, they're one thing, but they're put together. So if you ever happen to notice that, it's the same exact list, but it's just enumerated differently in the two sources. So what are the 13 types? And we're going to read through this. And we're also going to look at it in Gampopa for those who are able to stay for that. So 13 types of working for the benefit of others. And this is our job as bodhisattvas. These are not just nice things to do. It's our job to do these things. It's how we wake up. It's how we practice the paramita of skillful action or ethical conduct. So number one, helping those who perform beneficial activities. Number two, alleviating the sufferings of all beings. You see somebody suffering, it's your job to help them not suffer if you possibly can. If you can't, it's your job to aspire, to wish for them not to have suffering, and to aspire to be able to help them at some point. Number three, instructing those who are ignorant. And we're going to go into this more. I'm not going to dwell too much on like what the meanings are, because I want to look at it in Gampopa. And I had to sort it out in Gampopa because the translations are quite different in Ornament of Precious Liberation versus the older translation, Jewel Ornament. And I didn't like either one better than the other in the sum. So we're going to kind of combine them. So we're not going to worry too much about each individual thing and analyzing it, but just most of them will know exactly what it means. Instructing those who are ignorant probably means helping them with understand karma and helping them understand the Dharma, even if it's not in Dharmic terms, Buddhist terms. Number four, being grateful and returning favors one has received. In short, repaying kindness. If someone's kind to you, it's your job to remember that and to repay it if you can. Protecting those who are afraid. Where have we seen that before? That's the second kind of generosity. And you know, the other paramitas are in these. You can see them in these. Relieving the pain of those who suffer. So I guess that's different from alleviating suffering. Like, relieving the pain of those who suffer is a separate entry here. Giving what they lack to those who are in need. Homeless person, if you can give them something, it's our job. Rejoicing in virtuous actions. Okay. So I think that means other people's virtuous actions. Certainly we should rejoice in our virtuous actions too, but if someone else engages in virtue, helps somebody, then we rejoice in that. It's our job. We don't just overlook it or dismiss it. We actually need to rejoice in it. Correctly accomplishing one's spiritual practice, helping others to develop their potential and find contentment, eliminating what needs eliminating. We'll have to look at Gompopa for that. Inspiring respect by one's talents. And 13th, oh, we're already at the end, motivating people to aspire to what is good and beneficial. So I think it's a little clearer in Gompopa, like exactly what some of these mean. But what it means, like the whole thing boils down to, if you see somebody needs help and you can help them in some way through body, speech, or mind, then you do it if you can. You do it to the best of your ability. You won't always know the best way to help because we're still cultivating wisdom, but we cultivate our compassion, both wisdom and compassion, by engaging in these ways. So the 13 points to tie up Ringu Tulku's commentary here, and it will be before 3 o'clock. These 13 points are generally further classified into four groups, and he doesn't really do like a close analysis here, so it's just a general idea that there are four groups and these 13 can be divided up and fit into, you know, those categories. The first of these four groups comprises the activities that put into practice the paramita of generosity. So I think we saw a couple that were aspects of generosity. Giving material assistance, protection, or teachings is the first way to help people. So that is generosity. The second comprises beneficial advice and clear, comprehensible explanations, which draw people in the right direction toward the Dharma. The third point underlines the importance of practicing what one teaches. So we not only have to share the Dharma with people, but we actually have to practice what we're sharing. Everything that one says or teaches is useless and can even be harmful if there is no coherence between one's principles and practice. Another thing we may have some experience with, of observing, let us say. And then finally, the fourth category, or the last point, insists on the necessity, whatever our own level, of placing ourselves at the level of the people we are helping. And this is a humongously important point. And this is something that, you know, I've live streamed 4 or 5 now of Pema Chidren's, you know, seminars at Omega. And this is something, when she talks about compassion, she always talks about this, that true compassion is not from high to low. It's between equals. You always see the person. Excuse me. You always see the person as your equal, whether it be, you know, your actual peer, or it's a homeless person on the street that you're helping, or a child. You always see them as your equal. It's not true compassion if you look down on them in some way. And I'm just pointing this out. I'm sure we already all do that, but certainly sometimes there can be the sort of the reflexive, you know, perception of a situation as, oh, you know, I'm somehow more developed or more cultivated or whatever than this person that I'm helping, being generous enough to help. So when we recognize that happening, then we want to dial it back to equal to equal. So his last sentence, we must give others what they need insofar as it is not in conflict with our vows. If someone needs us to go to their house and kill all the ants in their kitchen, we probably can't do that. But they'll have to find someone else to do that. All right, so that's the end of Ringu Tulku's commentary. And so I do want to look a little bit at Gompopa, not in detail, you know, and comments, questions, insights, welcome anytime. And a little bit, just a little bit of Trungpa Rinpoche's Training the Mind. Anybody have any questions or comments, especially if you're about to leave? Namdok, I think we're about to lose you, right? Were you the 3 o'clock person? Oh, 10 more minutes? Okay, great. Oh, Dan, did you have to leave at 3? Was that you? I'm just going to unmute you for a second because it's 4 minutes to 3. So yeah, glad you could join us today.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
And you're still working on Thursday nights?
Yeah. Sometimes I get off early. Are you going to be at Ekoji
Yeah,
tonight?
I'm pretty much there every week now. You
Okay,
know,
cool.
daylight saving time helps a lot, but also having a really functional sangha where all I have to do is show up is really helpful.
Yeah,
And now
last week
I
I.
have my husband to drive me there and back, so no more night
Oh,
driving.
that's
Yes,
good. That's
all of
good.
those things
Yeah.
contribute to me being able to be there every week.
Well, I'm going to try to come tonight. I got off
Okay.
last week at 7:30, so hopefully I'll be off a
Oh,
little earlier.
yes. We'll hope to see you. If we
Okay.
don't, then I hope to see you soon. And
We'll
glad you're
try.
back in Richmond. And
Me
good luck
too.
with the house.
Thank you.
Okay,
Bye.
bye. And love to Clementine. Okay, anybody have anything that they would like to say or ask about the paramita of ethical conduct or skillful action? Yes, Deidre, I shall unmute you.
This is kind of goes to the generosity from earlier, but it's just something I wanted to share that I found work really good with, like giving to homeless people. You know, we all feel awkward when we see somebody, and you don't want to have to open your purse or your wallet and fumble for change and stuff. So, and the giving from one hand to the other. So, I found a way to give my pocket like $5. I put it in my back pocket and then I let go of it. And then if I see somebody, I don't have to fish for it. And I know that's what I'm willing to give. And it's like not coming from me, it's from my pocket.
That's lovely. I actually keep some bills in my car, same thing. Although
Same
sometimes I
thing.
forget to replenish it and then I'm like, oh crap. I really don't
Yeah.
have time at the stoplight to go into my purse and find it. And I don't know if I have any like small bills or whatever I want to give.
Right.
That's really great. That's really great advice. Anybody else have anything? Well, then we're going to look at Gompopa a bit. Okay, I'm in again, Ornament of Precious Liberation. But this week I had a little bit of leisure to also, and also because it's this chapter, and I don't, you know, I love Ken's translation, but there are some times when I prefer another translation, and I've been using Jewel Ornament a lot this week for this chapter. I don't always have time to look. I wish I did. Oops. Okay, I think I just accidentally made my screen small. Okay, my keyboard's right in front of me. So anything could happen. So in Gompopa, it's called The Perfection of Moral Discipline. It starts on page 169. And we're not going to look at the details, but I hope that you have had a chance to read the whole thing through and that you will study it from time to time. This chapter is worth reading because there's so much news you can use in it, things you can apply to your life on a daily basis. So his first point of his topics is the drawback of its absence and the benefits of its practice. And I just always have to read this sentence. Jinzang doesn't always, but I always love this about Gompopa. He begins every after the chapter on generosity, he begins every single chapter by pointing out, well, that's great if you perfect generosity, but if you don't also perfect this next one, then you're not gonna reach full enlightenment. So here he says, someone possessing the quality of generosity but lacking moral discipline will be unable to obtain the very best physical, human, or divine existence. So we need to practice generosity but also moral discipline. And that will go on when we get to patience. Oh, it's great that you have generosity and moral discipline, but you need patience. So he sort of gently drops us in. It's not like at the beginning, oh, you got to have all of these things. It's just gently, okay, now you've worked on generosity a little bit. Well, we need to also look at skillful action. All right. So and basically if you the drawback is the same on all of them. You just won't become fully enlightened. You won't become fully awakened without all six paramitas. So skipping way ahead because we don't need to talk more about that. Do I need? Oh yeah. Okay. I found this interesting. Okay. The nature. So the definition. He calls it the nature. Ken calls it the nature. In Jewel Ornament, it's called the definition. Each of the paramitas has one, and it's good to know exactly what is it we're talking about. Exactly what defines this practice. So we saw with generosity, it is to give completely something of value without attachment. The one for ethics is much harder to decipher. You can't like capsulize it. It says the essential nature of moral discipline should be known as having four qualities. What are these four? And here, I don't like the translation here of the first one. I think it's obfuscating. And so I'm gonna just read it instead of from here. I'm just gonna read it from Jewel Ornament. It's the same exact thing. It's just worded a little differently. Definition. The definition of moral ethics has four qualities. What are these four? Taking precepts perfectly from others. So Ken says it has been adopted from another. To me, it's not really clear what that means. So it means taking vows. So if you're taking vows, it means you have to have them from a person who's qualified to give them, and you have to take them in the right frame of mind. So that's the first part of ethical conduct. So again, Gampopa is operating here from the assumption, as he lives in a monastery and is a monastic abbot, that everyone's going to take vows. So that's not the case for us. But if you take vows, take them properly. Second one is to have pure motivation in your actions, all of your actions. Third one, to renew your practice if it declines. So if you fall off, if you backtrack, backslide, if you make a mistake, then you renew it. You just come back to it. You recognize your mistake and you just keep going full force. And then fourth, having mindfulness and respect so that one's practice will not decline. So keeping an eye on it, knowing whether you're practicing it or not. So those are the four aspects, the four parts of the definition of ethical conduct. And so they all have to be present. And I would say even if you're not taking vows, so the first one would seem not to apply, I think it means know what ethical conduct is, because that's what the vows tell you. So you know what it is from reading this chapter, from seeing these lists. And just from bearing in mind, anything that harms another person is not ethical conduct. Anything that does not reinforce and strengthen my bodhicitta does not fall within ethical conduct. And benefiting beings is my job. If you remember, alleviating the suffering of beings and helping beings in any way I can is my job. Those are the three things that are important. So in terms of its different aspects, okay, so we already read this in Ringu Tulku, so we're just going to touch on it here on page 171. What are the different aspects of what he calls moral discipline here? We're calling ethical conduct or skillful action. One, the moral discipline of restraint, not harming anyone. The moral discipline of amassing virtues, that's anything that earns merit, anything that strengthens your wisdom and compassion. We already saw that. And the moral discipline of working for the welfare of others. So again, this is a list to memorize. This is a list to know. Always know whether your activity is actually falling into these categories and counts as ethical conduct. Because the more that it does, the more you progress on the path of a bodhisattva, the path to awakening. So, we're not going to go into details on moral discipline, but so he says on page 172, all of these vows, he discusses the vows a little bit, the different levels of vows, and is all of these vows represent turning away from harming others, as well as from the basis of such harm. So that's what we really have to remember. Like if we don't hold vows, we just remember that it's our job, if we want to wake up, to not harm others in any way and really be careful about that. So now he's about pure motivation. I'm going to read this whole little section because I think it's really helpful. Moral discipline or ethical conduct is not to be observed in order to gain royal status, nor for the sake of higher rebirth, nor to become like Indra or Brahma, a god, nor for the sake of possessions, nor for the sake of physical well-being, and so on. So if your motivation for practicing ethical conduct, for benefiting another being, for example, is to benefit yourself in some way, then it's not pure motivation. And so it's not pure ethical conduct. Likewise, moral discipline is not to be observed through fear of the horrors of rebirth in hell, fear of rebirth in animal states, or fear of the terrifying worlds of the Lord of Death. So fear isn't a pure motivation either, although all of these can be useful. If they point us in the direction of action that benefits others and doesn't harm others, then it's still good, even if our motivation isn't pure. But again, we're talking about wanting to wake up completely. So this is the guideline for waking up completely. We will be working on all these frontiers. As Pema Chodron says, it's a work in progress. It's a journey. So also, not for those sorts of things, okay, not for any of those things. Those would be impure motivations or partial motivations. But through considering it as the way to enlightenment is moral discipline observed. And so that every being can be drawn closer to what is beneficial and joyous. In short, bodhisattva motivation, bodhicitta. We do it in order to wake up and to help other beings, A, wake up, and B, have a happier, better life. So we help beings in ways that don't necessarily help them wake up. You know, we don't have control over that. We would help someone who wasn't a Buddhist, you know, give them a cup of tea if they're thirsty. Like, that counts for us, but it's not helping them wake up necessarily. So we're skipping all of this really interesting stuff, pages 172 and 172, the lists of like the 14 root infractions. They're very interesting, like the things we refrain from as Dharma practitioners, and in some cases specifically monastic practitioners. So you can read those and study those. But I did want on 174 to, it says, as for the 46 faults, like what is that? And the examples he gives from the 46 faults are not making offerings to the three jewels three times daily, not being carried away by desires. Again, we're talking to monastics here, but I remembered that in training the mind, and I have the little teeny pocket version, training the mind and cultivating loving kindness by Trungpa Rinpoche. And this is a wonderful book on 7 points of mind training. If you were going to read anything else besides Jamgon Kongchul's Great Path of Awakening, I find this one extremely helpful and sometimes very 60s and 70s in its presentation. the essence of Trungpa Rinpoche. But at the end of it, it has an appendix. It has some very nice things at the end of the book. And one of them is 46 ways in which a bodhisattva fails. That's the 46 faults. And I know it's the right list, A, because it's 46, and how many lists of 46 can there be? But also because it starts out the same way. So it's a really useful list. And if you have this book, I might even have it typed up somewhere. If I do, I'll send it to everybody. But what's interesting about it in this context is that a lot of it is about the paramitas, like ways to fail to practice generosity, ways to fail to practice ethical conduct, ways to fail to practice patience. Just to give examples, so the ways that you fail to practice generosity are: you don't make offerings to the three jewels, you give in to possessiveness, you don't give something away, you don't respect more experienced people or answer questions. These fall under like not practicing protection from fear or support. Not accepting invitations as a guest and angrily refusing gifts is an infraction of your bodhicitta, and it's an infraction of the generosity paramita according to Trungpa Rinpoche. And of course, he didn't make up this list. This is like a traditional list. Contradictions to the paramita of discipline, rejecting those who do not keep their discipline. We're not allowed to be judgmental. I mean, we have no loopholes. There's no loopholes where we can get like a samsaric satisfaction out of anything. We're completely giving up all samsaric motivation and all samsaric, you know, tainted happiness. So if someone else doesn't keep their discipline, we're not allowed to like shun them. Not developing learning, which inspires others' faith. We're not allowed not to study the Dharma and improve our understanding of the Dharma. Making little effort for the benefit of sentient beings. Well, that's baked in, right, into the, you know, three aspects in Gampopa. And here's the really eye-popping one. Not performing evil actions, even though it is permitted when one has compassion and there is a need. So you have to do something bad as a bodhisattva if that's the thing that will help the other party. That's tricky. So always err on the side. My guideline is always err on the side of not harming others. But if it's really, really clear, you know, tell the lie. I think don't kill the ant. Like, I'm not sure that we could do that skillfully, but you might have to steal something from somebody, like for the greater good. So not doing that is an infraction of our bodhicitta. Anyway, so it goes on and on. Contradictions to the paramita of patience, not practicing the four dharmas of a practitioner. That's a lovely list. I'm going to leave you in suspense. It's coming up in the next chapter, but it's one of my favorite things, the four dharmas, of the four ways that a dharma practitioner is supposed to act with regard to patience. Not working peacefully with, but rejecting people who are angry at you. So if someone's angry with you, it's an infraction not to try to work with them. You can't just run away as a bodhisattva. Now, sometimes we have to run away, and that's the best thing to do because we don't have control over our speech and our actions. Don't hit them. Like, run away. Don't hit them. Don't yell at them. If you're going to hit or yell at them, better to escape. But if you can refrain from negativity of speech and action, if you're able to stay with it and work with them to a peaceful solution, however angry they might be, that is the practice of a bodhisattva. And if you have the ability to do it and you don't, that's the infraction. Refusing to accept another's apology. Ever done that? Giving in to anger, that's an obvious one. So anyway, so it goes on and on. There's 46 of them, and obviously I'm not going to have time to read them all, but if I do have the typed up list somewhere, I will send it. So it's intricate. It's intricate. We see from these pages that I skipped the lists of ways to fail. There's so many. You know, what is it called? The practice that they do at KTC that I haven't done in quite a long time, the recitation of the vows every morning. It's really like stuff you confess and swear never to do again, the five actions of immediate consequence, the 10 unvirtuous actions, the 14 root infractions, the 18 this, the 19 that. You name them all and you confess them all. I mean, in monastic life, it's very important to keep them all in mind, and that's what's in your face, is you're constantly reminded of these vows and what ethical conduct is. So let's finish up Gampo, because I just love these lists. So the second moral discipline of amassing virtues, cultivating your own bodhicitta, is as follows. I was going to read these. We have time. I'm going to read them. Anybody object to having them read again? Because we read them in Ringu Tulku. All right. Because I think the Gampopa is really helpful. So the following is to be understood, I'm on page 174, as being the bodhisattva's moral discipline. In Jewel Ornament, it's 198. The following is to be understood as being the bodhisattva's moral discipline or ethical conduct or skillful action of amassing what is virtuous, collecting virtue. Relying on and abiding with within the Buddha, and I think this is one of the places where, this isn't the one that Ringu Tukul made longer, never mind. So relying on and abiding within the bodhisattva's moral discipline, keeping moral discipline number one. Enthusiastically applying yourself to study, contemplation, and meditation. Maintaining solitude for your meditation. You know, it really means meditate, like be in a place where you're not distracted when you can. So again, this is reinforcing our own bodhicitta. These are the ways: respecting teachers and serving them, and serving and caring for the sick. Giving properly, being generous properly, proclaiming good qualities. We're starting to mesh here with the 37 practices, you know, Bodhisattva boot camp. Somebody denigrates you, you proclaim their good qualities. To appreciate the attributes of others and to be patient with those who are scornful. In Jewel Ornament, the translation there is to be patient when others look down on you. Again, echoing the 37 practices. It is to dedicate virtue to enlightenment. Don't forget your dedications. And make earnest prayers, or Jewel Ornament says aspiration prayers. Don't forget aspiration prayers. To make offerings to the three jewels and strive to be diligent. To be ever caring and careful. To be mindful of the training and through awareness to keep to it. So that's the mindfulness and vigilance thing. Also 37 practices. Always to know what you're doing and whether it's the right thing to do. Like really watch your mental verbal and physical conduct and correct it if it needs to be corrected. To guard the doors of the senses and to know how much to consume. So don't be distracted by sensory input. You know, don't get drawn to beautiful things or, you know, consumed by beautiful sounds or, you know, whatever it is. Don't let it distract you from your practice. And to know how much to consume. And that might be a better translation than Jewel Ornament. Jewel Ornament says, eat in moderation. Mm-hmm. That's pretty clear. Like, consume moderately. Like, it's the bodhisattva practice not to overeat, you know, not to overdo. But to know how much to consume also, I mean, in our culture, at least, you know, it could apply to any kind of addictive behavior. Like, moderate your addictive behavior, whatever it is. And this one, to not sleep in the first and last parts of the night. The Jewel Ornament says, don't sleep too early or too late. Like, don't go to bed too early when you could be practicing. Don't get up late when you could be using that time to practice. And use that time to make efforts in meditation practice, is what Jewel Ornament says. Don't oversleep. Don't be too attached to sleep. Or it will impair your own cultivation of bodhicitta. To rely on holy individuals and Dharma masters and to examine delusions, admit them, and get rid of them. Jewel Ornament calls it mistakes, to investigate mistakes. When you make a mistake or you see that you're operating from a deluded, you know, concept, when you see that you're operating out of confusion, look at that. Like, really look at that, own up to it, and let go of that behavior. These sorts of qualities need to be practiced, nurtured, and thoroughly increased. So you see how specific it all is. It's really spelled out for us. So that's the first two, refraining from harm in all its aspects and cultivating bodhicitta in all of its aspects. And now the third, the moral discipline of working for the welfare of others, of benefiting others, can be known in brief in terms of 11 or 13, if you are a student of Rinku Tulku. What are they? And bodhisattva levels here, I think that's a sangha, but anyway. So here's the list. To support those doing worthwhile activities. You know, that could be our teachers, but it could be anybody who's helping others. Support Mother Teresa, you know. We could be financially supporting things. There's all kinds of opportunities for that. Or we could be helping them. Or we could just be, you know, having a good attitude towards them and promoting them. If someone's doing good in the world, we support that. To remove the suffering of beings in torment, or Jewel Ornament just says to remove the suffering of beings who are suffering. I don't think it has to be torment, but I don't know what the Tibetan word was because I didn't look it up. Help anybody who's suffering. Help them not suffer if you can. To teach those without skill how to deal with things intelligently. Jewel Ornament says, show methods to those who don't know them. So how to live a happy life or how to do a ritual or, you know, how to chant something, whatever it is. I'm not sure 100% what's being referred to here, but it probably covers all of it. Teach someone how to chant Chenrezig properly or to meditate properly. To recognize others' kindness and to render benefit in return. I think he might just be trying to avoid using the same words as Jewel Ornament, which just says repay it. Recognize others' kindness and repay it. Protect beings from dangers. Jewel Ornament says fears covers all of it. And again, that falls within generosity. To alleviate the distress of those who are suffering. So how is that different from the previous one, removing the suffering of beings in torment, to alleviate the distress of those who are suffering. It might be two different things. I mean, obviously it is two different things if it's two different listings. So maybe it means to actually do whatever has to be done to remove the suffering itself, and then to also remove the distress of the person who's suffering. You know, whether or not you can help with the thing itself, maybe you can help them be less distressed. That's how I read it. To provide those deprived of resources with provisions. Jewel Ornament translates this one, give necessities to those who don't have them. which to me is a little clearer. It's a little less convoluted. People, somebody needs something, give it to them if you can. Help them get it if you can. And then these last ones are more for like a Dharma teacher, because again, his audience is monastics. So again, you know, it's helpful to us to remember who his audience was, so that we don't necessarily think we have to be practicing every single thing. Here, to whatever extent you are a teacher of Dharma, you skillfully assemble a Dharma following. You engage them in accordance with their mentalities. Jill Arnament says level of understanding. Engage them in accordance with their level of understanding. I like that a bit better. To make them happy through the very finest of qualities. Not quite sure what that means. It might have to do with one's own conduct. And to tame the wrathful with firmness is like a little odd to me. It's what Jill Arnament says, to tame anyone who is doing wrong, like help them tone it down, whatever, help them, you know, come down from their rage or, you know, their intense desire or whatever it is before they themselves engage in harmful action based on it. So help others tame their emotions with firmness. And last one, to inspire awe through extraordinary abilities and longing for the good and wholesome. Jill Arnament, again, I liked better. It says, can't read my note. Something other to be inspired, cause others to be inspired by the teachings. So many of us are out in the field doing that. On whatever level we do it, leading meditation, leading practice, maintaining a Dharma center, or just in our day-to-day activities. So those are the lists. And you can see there's a lot of information there. So I think it's really helpful. I only do this when I teach it mostly. I'm resolving that I should look at it more often now. All of the paramitas, they're so full of really practical information that will help us wake up and travel the path. So then we have this really interesting section that Rinku Tulku stayed away from or didn't get into, of how specifically should a bodhisattva, an aspiring bodhisattva, comport themselves. And we don't have time to go into them really, but it's mostly taken from Shantideva. Shantideva chapter 5, which is, I forget what, it might be ethical conduct. Anyway, chapter 5 in Shantideva, if you have Shantideva, that's where these are. And if you have Ornament of Precious Liberation, this translation, it gives you the citation. At the end of each verse, it says 5:71, for example. That means chapter 5, verse 71. So it's easy to look them up. And I don't like Ken's translations here. I sadly don't like them so much. I use Stephen Batchelor's, which is what's quoted in the Jewel Ornament, is the Stephen Batchelor translations. But the first one, we'll just touch on these. Always smile, always have a face that's, you know, with pleasant emotion. Like, don't frown at people, don't look meanly at people. Always maintain like equanimity and smiling countenance kind of thing. In the next verse, when looking at others, look at them in a pleasant, kind way, knowing that it is through them that you will become a Buddha. So that's how you can look kindly at someone who's behaving really badly, is remember that through looking kindly at them, through remembering your aspirations, through dealing with their behavior in a bodhisattva-like way, that is going to make you a Buddha. If you lose your temper with them, or you say something mean to them, or call them on their behavior, even if it's not necessary, that's not the path. And we're going to see that more clearly in the chapter on patience. Do not sit with legs outstretched or fidget with the hands. When eating, do not overfill your mouth or chew noisily with the mouth agape. Like, you want to comport yourself in a way that is pleasant for people to relate to. And one of the things, if you remember, in the chapter on the guru, on the spiritual teacher, I'm not sure if it's in Gampopa, but it's in a lot of sources when they talk about qualities to look for in a guru. You can't take your eyes off them. So if the Karmapa was fidgeting and eating with his mouth open, like, we might want to look away a little bit. So he has to always remember, and he knows this stuff. He's studied this stuff. He's had it beaten into him, probably literally. You know, comport yourself in a way that people won't want to take their eyes off you. It's always pleasant and engaging and magnetizing to look at. Do not be noisy and hasty when getting up from a seat. Do not slam doors. Take pleasure in being unobtrusive. I think that is just lovely. Take pleasure in being unobtrusive. This is a lovely section to read too. There were a couple that with regard to impure speech on 176, you should give up excessive or harsh speech, covered again in the 37 practices near the end in that list. It's verses 31 through 34, the four sutra things. All right, so we'll tie this up now. The impurity of mental engagement on 177. So those, impurities of body, speech, and mind. Body is don't slam doors and enjoy being unobtrusive. Speech is don't speak harshly and or excessively, refrain from idle speech. And then mental, don't cling to material gifts and honors. That's also in the 31 through 34, as well as being attached to sleep and mental dullness. Don't oversleep. That's how you benefit others. And it's also how you be a pure bodhisattva. So a couple more things. So on 178, also the essence of bodhisattva conduct, and especially mentally, is having considered in this manner, it's above, at the top of the page, reduce your desires and be content with what you have. How many times have we heard that from our teachers? Be content, don't need more than you have. So bottom of the page. So the sixth topic. So we didn't enumerate the topics here, but the sixth topic, almost the end, making one's moral discipline pure, it refers us back to generosity, which is on page 165. These last three, making it pure, what are the results and how to enhance it? I'm not seeing that here. Are in all of the paramitas. And so I'm going to read it actually on page 165 from generosity. How do you make it pure? So you're doing all the right things. You're engaging in all the activities of ethical conduct or skillful action, but it could be done at an ordinary level, like an impure level. So what makes it pure? And we all know the answer to that, even though this isn't the way it's usually expressed, like making it pure. On 165, how generosity can be made pure, applying emptiness with compassion as its essence, virtue will be made pure. So that's going to apply to every single paramita. It is the wisdom paramita. This is actually where the wisdom paramita transforms each of the other paramitas into an actual paramita, something that can take us to the other shore, the shore of Buddhism. So he says, when the above-mentioned forms of generosity, you could also substitute ethical conduct, are supported by realization of emptiness, they will not become a cause for samsara. So they free us from samsara. They serve as that boat to the other shore. Only when we engage in them within the realization of emptiness, their empty nature. And then the other point, when they are supported by compassion. So that's wisdom, to realize their emptiness. When they are supported by compassion, they will not become a cause for attaining the Hinayana. And that just means, in the Mahayana, Hinayana is considered a partial path because you don't specifically cultivate compassion. So you still have a little ways to go. So we won't get stuck there in those four formless realms. This is also 37 practices. You won't get stuck in the four formless realms if you remember compassion in all of your practice and all your paramita practice. And I think that might be it. We're not going to read that. Oh yeah. Okay. So let's go on to down a little further in this little quoted part. Practice generosity by applying four seals to it. The seal of emptiness of the inner one's body. Oh no, that's not actually, I'm not going to read the rest of that. That's not what I thought it was. So what are the benefits? What are the results of practicing ethical conduct? At the bottom of page 165, there are temporary and ultimate terms, and ultimately generosity brings total enlightenment, but not without the other five paramitas, as Gampopa will remind us again and again. But with generosity, with the six paramitas, we attain enlightenment. Without them, we don't. And then on page 166, the temporary results are that material giving brings the most perfect wealth, even if one does not desire it. So ultimately we attain Buddhahood, we attain awakening. Temporarily, we attain good conditions. In this case, with generosity, it's wealth, and with moral discipline, he doesn't say, and I don't remember if I've been taught it. So that is the book. Oh, and also on 179, sorry. Yes, temporary results, whether sought or not, are to obtain greatest happiness and well-being within the samsaric world. And then a little below that, there may be these worldly delights and joys. Like, samsara can be very beguiling and enticing, yet the bodhisattva will not be dazzled by them and will enter the path to enlightenment. So we'll keep our eye, it's through ethical conduct, we keep our eye on the ball, so to speak. We keep our goal in mind and we don't get distracted. We don't fall into distraction that will cause us to stray from the path. So I see we are out of time. Anybody have any questions or comments before we do the dedication? Okay. Was this class all right? Because often we do get more comments. All right. So let's straighten our posture and relax our bodies. Bring our minds to rest for a moment. Dedication of merit was one of the ways to strengthen our bodhicitta. It fell into the second category of skillful action. So we are practicing a skillful action as well as generosity and really all the other paramitas. If we remember the emptiness of this all, it's the wisdom paramita. So remembering the paramitas, we will dedicate the merit. This merit, may it win omniscience, defeat my faults, the enemy. Then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, Kuntu, Zangpo, and Manjushri. To train myself in their example, I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate, the blessings of the Buddhakayas, the blessings of changeless dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast sangha. This dedication please fulfill. And letting our minds rest just for a moment, I will unmute everyone. All right, everybody's unmuted. Well, thanks for being here in our small group today.
Thank you.
Thanks for teaching.
Lots of my pleasure.
I love this chapter. I love all the paramitas. Patience is actually my very favorite chapter, but Lama Jinzan gets to teach that next time. So I hope everything's all right at KTC. I didn't hear from her that she wouldn't be here. So I hope things are all right. All right, wishing everybody a fabulous week.
Thank you, children.
See you next time, wherever it may be. And I will end the meeting.